Chapter 17. Tutula's fingers softly and expertly slid over the flight controls, making tiny adjustments to the aircraft's relatively leisurely progress over the surface. The Ruhar controls had been designed to be used by four fingers and a thumb, making it somewhat awkward for the three-fingered Kristang, and the controls could only be modified to a limited extent. In that regard, the slow and primitive humans had an advantage over their Kristang comrades in arms, and Tutula was consoled by reminding herself she was more advanced in almost every other way. Her genetically modified strength, speed, coordination, and reactions made her physically far superior to any human, and awkward flight controls would be no obstacle to achieving her assigned mission.
Hawk 2 in position and ready,
she announced as her dropship raced over an imaginary line on the hills below. She was flying the only fighter dropship they had brought down from the route to Stella, a craft the humans called a vulture. "Stand by, too," the voice of Lieutenant Colonel Perkins ordered, and Tutula did not react other than her pupils widening slightly, a sign of pleasure among her species. When Tutula's people had first heard of the low-tech species who called themselves humans, she feared their culture would be cruel and oppressive to their females, either by nature or as distorted by the warrior caste of the Kristang. She had been extremely pleased to learn that human civilian and military organizations included females in positions of authority, even at the highest level. Perkins and General Bezensen were the two highest-ranking humans that Tutula knew of. The fact they were both female was encouraging. Hawk 2, you are go to proceed.
Acknowledged, Hawk Lead,
Tutula responded, and this time there was no mistaking her emotions. Her lips pulled back in a toothy grin as she contemplated the prospect of striking a direct blow against the warrior caste.
"Missiles on automatic," she reported,
seeing on a side display that the other dropship's missile launchers had also been released to the auto-fire system. She advanced her throttle slightly to avoid losing airspeed as she pulled the nose up to crest the ridge of foothills and began climbing the tall mountains that ringed the valley where the research base sprawled across the dusty ground. When the navigation system determined she had reached a preset distance from the target, the Vulture's missile bay doors snapped open, and the rotary launchers spat out their deadly payloads, all of them. First in flight were the anti-AA missiles the humans for some reason called Wild Weasels, to scramble sensors and destroy the base's air defense maser cannon. Right behind were general-purpose missiles with pre-selected targets, and finally, a volley of missiles that could be retasked in flight as needed. This last group could extend their wings and loiter above the base for up to 20 minutes, but the attackers all knew the fight would be over in the first 3 minutes, or not at all. With her ship's entire missile payload expended and running on ahead in parallel with the other dropship's warbirds, Tutula saw a blue light flash on her console, and she reacted immediately, using a thumb to press the throttles to maximum. With missiles already approaching the mountain ridge, there was no longer a need to keep her speed subsonic. Shockwaves from the low-level passage of the missile formation were causing dust to swirl on the slopes of the mountains. The sonic boom of her passage would not be noticed in the chaos. With the corner of one eye, she verified the enemy base defenses had not yet reacted. The previous day, the tiny drones planted by the attackers had begun intermittently jamming the base's sensor network, turning the silent jamming on for brief periods. They knew from listening to the base communications system that the personnel there were angry and frustrated at what they assumed was an old and glitchy sensor network, and after 14 hours those Kristang had thrown up their hands and stopped trying to diagnose the problem. At first they had put defenses on alert and sent teams out to scan for danger. But when nothing was found again and again, they decided to ignore the glitches and not waste time trying to fix an antiquated system on an uninhabited and useless planet. That was why the defenders did not react when the jamming started again, just before the dropships launched their missiles. Actually, one of the defenders did react, but that reaction was an unhelpful gesture of slamming a rifle butt into the display screen of the sensor system when it apparently began glitching again. That move made the other guard on duty laugh, and delayed their reactions a half second when more than 24 missiles screamed over the ridge of mountains to the south, and no one could be under the delusion that the base's sensors merely had a glitch. Tutula's ship was moving so fast, she had to roll it upside down and fire the belly jets as she passed over the sharp crest of the mountain ridge.
The belly jets pushed the Vulture down, so momentum did not carry it far out over the valley. Hanging in the sky on a high ballistic arc would not have been good for her survival, especially as her ship was momentarily lit by the sun that was just rising over the mountain ridge to the east. She grunted from the strain as she was squashed down in her seat, waiting so long to cut the jets and flip upright that her ship came heart-stoppingly close to scraping on the mountainside. Ignoring the G-force-induced haze in her vision, she flipped up a switch to enable the ship's maser cannons and searched for targets, even as she watched missile warheads exploding on the floor of the valley below. The personnel at the base, having no idea they were about to be thrust into the role of active defenders on a worthless planet that was unoccupied, were so bored and sick and tired and disgusted and generally pissed off that early morning. They were not entirely sure about the purpose of their mission, because the asshole scientists who were so important and smart as they huddled in their research compound had not bothered to inform the guards about the experiments they were conducting. But the guards were sure the mission was over, because the scientists and their staff and most of the primitive humans had already left the planet, yet the guards were still stuck there. Every single one of the guards had prayed for a serious accident to befall the dropship that had carried the scientists off the dusty surface, but their prayers had not been answered. Why hadn't the guards and the last group of humans been lifted away from the nasty prison of a planet that was about to be abandoned? Insurance. That was the only reason they had been given. Their remaining on the planet was a form of insurance, just in case something went wrong with the mission and more experiments needed to be conducted. When the mission, whatever it was, had been successfully completed, then and only then would a ship come to pull the guards and the last surviving humans off the surface. More than a few guards had speculated there would not be a ship coming at all, except maybe for the purpose of pounding the base into a smoking crater from orbit. A handful of guards were not worth the expense of sending a ship such a long distance across the star lanes, not with Kristang society engulfed in yet another civil war, and not when that star system was going to be abandoned as it was now too far from effective military support. Fretting that they had been discarded, angry at their impotence to control their fate, not having any clan leadership supervision, and just by nature being hateful assholes, the guards had taken to culling the remaining humans one by one or in pairs, to use for sport. At first they had dropped off humans on the other side of the mountain ridge where the stupid humans in their own compound at the base could not see what was happening. The first hunt had been frustrating. The Kristang simply dumped the former soldier on the ground and told him to run as they readied their hunting gear. That human evaded pursuit by unexpectedly going uphill and hiding in a shallow cavern. It was not until the next morning that the guards, having grown tired and frustrated and bored with the game, activated the tracking device they had injected into their quarry. At that point, angry they had been duped and had wasted most of a day looking in entirely the wrong place, they hammered the cavern with a missile, burying the human where he died. Subsequent hunts were scarcely more satisfying, as the star-blasted planet had no trees and their human prey had difficulty finding cover. Even arming the prey with primitive projectile pistols did not offer much sport, because being armed gave the prey a foolish sense of confidence and drew them out, where they were easily killed by the armor-suited hunters. After slaughtering four humans in hunts that were not much fun at all, the guards tried another game that offered much more sport. Unarmed combat. Taking off their armored suits, a guard went into a makeshift sparring ring with a human, and later, a pair of humans. Giving the humans short knives was necessary to make the combat interesting, though even then, the Kristang usually quickly took away the knives and turned them on the prey. The games were just getting fun, with two guards sustaining serious knife wounds, when their leader declared a stop to the games. They were running low on humans, so if the scientists ever did return and needed the humans for experiments, they would be extremely upset to find all the test subjects had been killed for sport. After the games were over, most of the guards had taken to sleeping late, since they had almost nothing to do other than making sure the remaining humans did not escape from their prison compound. Escape where? None of the native life was edible to humans, so other than a guard doing a remote head count twice a day, they ignored the humans and spent their time struggling against boredom. The only mildly interesting thing that had happened for weeks was an intermittent sensor glitch that no one cared enough about to diagnose. So, when a cloud of missiles streaked over the mountain ridge, followed by a pair of Ruhar dropships, The guards were caught completely by surprise. Most of them were asleep, with only two technically on duty and the base's security center. Those two froze for crucial seconds, disbelieving the attack could be real. Surely it had to be a surprise exercise thrown at them by the base commander, who had grown disgusted by his men's lack of discipline and the slovenly state of their quarters. The missiles had to be part of a simulation, and the guard who had smashed the glitchy sensor display was tempted to let the sim play out without reacting so the base commander would not get the satisfaction of seeing his men racing around for nothing. Then the ground shook as an incoming missile was exploded by the one functioning Mazer air defense cannon, and the two guards scrambled into action, triggering an alarm and powering up the defense shield that protected the control center. Raising that shield when the attack began might have been a good idea, but raising it as missiles were already impacting actually shortened the guards' lives. The first volley of missiles were weighted heavily toward taking out anti-aircraft defenses, concentrating on destroying the single active Mazer cannon turret. The missiles Irene had named Wild Weasels quickly overwhelmed the Mazer cannon, saturating its sensor network with submunitions that scrambled the sensor data or directly attacked the targeting sensors with their own single-use Mazer blasts. Within its armored turret, the computer controlling the Mazer cannon was calmly concentrating on prioritizing targets and trying to see through the confused sensor data when the thick armor of the turret cracked under direct impact of two shape-charge warheads. The superheated plasma of the warheads burned through the armor and fried the power feeds to the Mazer, rendering it useless and shattering the Mazer's exciters before it had a chance to even detect the pair of vulnerable dropships coming over the mountain crest behind the missiles. The second volley of missiles went straight for pre-programmed targets, flying violently erratic courses until the base's air defense was knocked offline, then giving up any evasive maneuvering and boring through the air straight at their designated targets. The enemy dropship was exploded to prevent that unflyable hulk being used as a stationary missile or Mazer cannon platform. Missiles plunged into the base housing, killing all the guards who were still asleep or racing out of warm beds to react to the threat. With all primary targets destroyed, most of the last wave of missiles queried the battle control systems aboard the lead dropship and were told to switch to secondary targets, then targets of opportunity. One missile, having already deployed its wings and opened air-breathing doors to extend the time it could loiter over the base, saw an opportunity. The base control center, considered both a hard target and unnecessary now that base air defense was down, had foolishly delayed raising the separate energy shield that protected it. "Well, ain't this some shit," the missile said to a missile orbiting in the air beside it. "Sloppy," the second missile's tiny yet intelligent brain responded over the tactical network. "They are way too slow." "I hate sloppy soldiers," the first missile declared. "I bet their bunks are unmade and their footlockers are unlocked. If there is one thing in this world that I hate, it is an unlocked footlocker." "Damn, that defense shield is still only 12% charged," the second missile noted with surprise and disgust. "Hey, I have an idea." The pair of missiles linked their targeting data, shed their wings, and closed their air-breathing ducts. Gouts of white-hot flame scorched the air behind them as they plunged downward, zipping through the strengthening energy shield as if it weren't there at all, and detonating their warheads on wide dispersal pattern. The brains of the two guards did not even have time to think, "Damn, this sucks," before they became dark stains on a wall just prior to that wall being churned into vapor. Ironically, the original assault plan had called for leaving the control center untouched in the initial phase because the attack planners had assumed the powerful energy shield would be active. The slow reaction of the guards prevented them from living long enough to see who had hit them. Sergeant Jaitz tensed, poised at the back ramp of the second dropship. The ramp was already opening as the craft first dropped sickeningly at a high-speed descent, then stood on its nose with forward thrusters firing to slow its progress as the ground rushed up to meet it. He felt the floor tilt, and he was grateful for the strong restraints that held him securely as his powered skin-suit legs absorbed the strain of the ship flaring to land. Jaitz knew his genetically enhanced body could take G-forces that would render a human unconscious. His concern was that he could not complete the task alone, and the Gerapta was needed for breaking into the research core. That left humans as his only assistants, and he was not confident as he glanced at the bio signs in a corner of his visor. All three of his team members were showing high heart rates, dangerous blood pressure, and were fluttering on the verge of unconsciousness. He noted two of them were slumping against their restraints, temporarily useless. The three sergeants did not appear to be very capable of performing the mission, but Yates reminded himself the warrior caste had been hurt very badly, twice, when they underestimated humans. Then he had no more time for worry, because the ramp was fully open and the ground was in sight. While the dropship was still 5 meters in the air, he popped free of the restraints and leaped out, diving headfirst through the opening, then flipping to fall feet first, trusting the skin suit and his enhanced bone structure and muscles to survive the fall. He hit hard and rolled in a well-practiced maneuver, the skin suit steadying him and helping flip him upright. As soon as his boots contacted the ground, he was running with power-boosted strides, keeping low, as time in the air between strides was time his legs could not propel him forward. The crater made by the missile that had cut the data link to the research compound was in front of him by another 40 meters, according to the glowing numbers at the bottom right of his helmet visor. An idle part of his brain told him 40 meters in the common human measurements the team used was 35 latrans in Cristang terms, a bit of trivia that became useless as his boots skidded and brought him to a halt at the blackened lip of the crater. The shape-charged warhead had focused its explosive energy downward to slice the buried cable, so the lip of the crater was only 8 meters across. But smoke and dust obscured even the enhanced vision provided by his helmet, and the crumbly dry sand the base was built on was already sliding down to fill in the hole. He pulled a compression grenade off his belt, checking to verify it was still on its lowest power setting, pressed the button with the thumb, and dropped it in the hole. There was a blast of air, but no shrapnel, so he did not bother to duck out of the way or even flinch, knowing the Ruhar skin suit and helmet would protect him. The blast momentarily cleared the air in the hole, creating a vacuum that was quickly erased by inrushing air that swirled with even more dust and smoke. That did not matter, as Jates's helmet sensor had built an accurate picture of the hole during the split second his vision had been clear. "We have a problem," he announced over the tactical circuit. "What is it?" Jesse asked as he skidded to a stop behind Jates almost too quickly, needing the Verdcris to steady him from toppling into the hole. Jates said nothing about the human's clumsiness, merely flexing his ankles to hop down into the dust-obscured hole. "Oh, shit," Jesse exclaimed as his visor fed him the synthetic view Jates had acquired. The missile had impacted at a junction where, sometime after the base was built, someone had spliced in a cable at a right angle, running back to a building behind Jesse. The junction was not a problem. The problem was someone had the bright idea to protect the splice by encasing it in a block of some hard ceramic material. Pieces of the ceramic had flaked away, and there were pockmarks on the side where the warhead had exploded, but the hard block was not cracked. "What about... can we blow it apart?" Shauna asked behind him, already unslinging her backpack that contained a mix of explosive charges that had been selected for various yields.
"We can try it," Dave suggested.
"Darling, no, not this time," Jesse declared as he slid down into the hole on his backside, the skin suit automatically stiffening to protect him from cuts and scrapes. "I only blew up one island, Jesse. This is not funny." "I'm all for blowing shit up, but we don't have time," Jesse cut her off. "Jates, this thing can't be that big. I can see the cable coming in from the side, and it looks to me it's not as thick as my arm is long. Can we just pull it away?" Jates had his gloves gripping the block on top and had been using his suit's power to nudge the block back and forth while the humans argued. His intent had been to judge the block's size by his ability to move it so they could scale explosives appropriately. He had not thought of simply moving the block out of the way. The human called Jesse, or Cornpone, had a point. They had precious little time before the data buffers overflowed.
"Sergeant Coulter, we can try. I will take this side."
Jesse grunted and strained to dig his gloved fingertips into the hard ceramic until he could see it was no use. He had to rely on the gecko-like grip of the gloves. Even they slipped, and he fell backwards just as the block began to move.
"I can't get a grip. It's too smooth," he spat in frustration.
Jates agreed without words, flexing his gloves that also had failed to gain a purchase.
28 seconds, guys," Dave warned, and just then, inspiration struck him. "Jates, Jesse, Duck down, he warned as he fell onto the block, feeling it rock beneath him. Pulling his rifle out of the sling, he selected explosive-tipped flechettes and shouted, Fire in the hole! Ow, shit! The explosive rounds barely had time to arm themselves after they left the gun barrel, as Dave had the muzzle almost too close to the block. Sharp chips of ceramic pelted his legs, faceplate, and worst of all, the crotch of his skin suit. He was saved only because the rifle had communicated with the suit, so the suit's computer stiffened the skin before the first round left the barrel.
Ugh, ah, God damn it!
Come on, Ski, quit whining, Jesse grunted as he grabbed his friend's legs and pulled him down to tumble awkwardly into the hole behind Jesse. He felt for a handhold blasted by the rifle and found several.
Got a grip now?
Yes, Jates acknowledged, and dug three fingers into cracks caused by the rifle rounds. 3, 2, 1, pull. The heavy block did not move at all. Then it moved all at once as it lost its grip on the soil around it. Jesse and Jates fell backward on top of Dave, and the block toppled over onto all three of them.
Don't you guys move, Shauna ordered. I see the end of the cable exposed. I'm reaching down for it.
13 seconds, Dave reported unseen from the bottom of the pile.
I know,
Shauna snapped with irritation, tossing aside her pack to get access to the only thing she needed right then, a data transmitter the size and shape of a golf ball. The ball had a hole which Shauna carefully fitted the cable end into, except the damned frayed cable caught on the lip of the hole and refused to go in.
Gotta cut a fresh end.
She pulled the knife off her belt and, holding the golf ball firmly but carefully, sliced through the cable to create a clean end. She dropped the knife and breathlessly threaded the cable into the hole of the golf ball. Instantly, her visor lit up to report a solid connection.
Got it. Colonel Perkins, we have a connection. Our fake sensor data is flowing through the cable.
I see it. Perkins's voice sounded shaky, which might have something to do with the timer showing the buffers would have overflowed in 8 seconds if Shauna had not hooked the computer into the cable. Or it could be not knowing whether the core in the research compound believed the bullshit sensor data fed into the cable. The data they fed in was simply recordings of real sensor input with the time codes adjusted, but the team had no way of knowing whether the core could tell it was being spoofed.
Good work.
Great,
Dave gasped from the bottom of the pile.
Did you guys get off of me? You're heavy.
Extracting themselves from the hole was not easy, as they could not simply push the ceramic block away without risk it might fall on the data transmitter. Shauna stayed holding the transmitter, wrapping a high-tech type of duct tape to hold it in place, while Jates and Jesse wriggled out from under the block, holding it up so Dave could crawl out.
Thanks, guys.
Dave stood up in the hole, brushing smeared dirt off his skin suit.
You okay, Ski?
Jesse inspected his friend's suit, not seeing any tears.
Yeah, I'm fine. The suit went rigid to protect me. Problem was, my legs were bent at a bad angle down in the hole when the suit locked up and I couldn't move.
Damn.
He glanced down at his thighs and crotch where ceramic chips had scratched the tough suit material.
I almost shot my balls off. Not doing that again.
He reached up to pull himself out of the hole, his head clearing the lip of the crater, and to use the chin of his helmet to dig into the crumbling soil.
Now we... Whoa!
He slid back into the hole as gunfire erupted, rounds biting into the crater lip where his head had been moments before.
We got company!
I see them.
Derek held his voice steady as he swiveled the Dodo dropship's belly maser cannon turret and sent withering fire toward a pair of Kristang who were shooting at the away team, stitching a line across the ground and slicing into one of the armor-suited figures.
Damn it,
Derek shouted, and the maser cut off.
Bring us around. That damned building got into my line of sight.
What's inside that building? Perkins asked from her console behind the pilots while her stomach flip-flopped from the tight turn Irene pulled the dropship into.
Nothing important,
Derek replied distractedly, concentrating on holding the targeting sensor on the gap between buildings where the enemy had been.
Then light it up, Perkins ordered. Away team, keep your heads down.
Yes, ma'am.
Derek cursed himself for not thinking of that.
On the way!
With the maser exciters cranked up to full power, the beam blasted the building apart, smoke, fire, and debris erupting skyward.
I can't see anything. Away team, you see any hostiles?
We can't see shit,
Jesse reported as a camera popped up above his helmet on a thin stalk, showing him only a chaotic cloud of dust and scorch-marked debris raining down. No way was he sticking his head above the crater lip until he was certain the two Kristang were dead.
Ow!
He ducked down as a chunk of debris clanked off his helmet.
We're getting pelted with building parts down here!
The transmitter is safe, Shauna assured the team as she huddled over the device, protecting it with her body.
Should I hold fire? Derek asked.
Hell no!
Jesse snorted. Seriously? He asked himself. The infantry have their asses hanging out to dry on the ground, and the close air support is asking whether to expend ordnance?
Hit it again! Maser beams don't cost us nothing!
Derek poured maser fire to saturate the area in case there were more Kristang hidden in the cluster of buildings, until there was no cluster of buildings, only shattered and smoking ruins, pieces of walls standing by themselves, and debris cascading down all over the area. Derek winced as he saw pieces of buildings spinning through the air in the direction of the research compound, and he was relieved to see puffs of dust kicked up on the ground as the chunks fell well short.
I've got nothing left to target, ma'am.
He glanced back to Perkins, just as his console flashed red with a new threat.
Shit! Irene, get us out of here now, 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 now!
The pair of Kristang who fired on the away team had intended to kill the attackers who were assumed to be Ruhar based on their familiar flexible skin suits, the rifles they carried, and most importantly, the unmistakable outlines of their dropships. The two guards had hurriedly pulled on their old third-hand powered armor suits, ignored the multiple warning lights of systems that had failed or were on the verge of failure, and emerged inside the building closest to the away team by using a tunnel that was not part of the original base construction. They did not know why the attacking aliens had bothered to drop down into a crater, in a part of the base that was not at all of any importance and was not near any of the tunnels. All they knew was they had been ordered to kill the aliens with maximum violence, and that is what they did. Except the maximum violence part was inflicted upon them by a dropship flying close air support. They died not knowing whether they had hit any of the aliens, and they died not knowing their part of the base defense was a decoy, a mere distraction. A quarter kilometer away from the away team, in an area of the base that appeared to be nothing but storage sheds, dirt and dust arced upward as two large buried doors swung open, revealing a ramp, and in a flash, a large vehicle was racing up the ramp to slew sideways to a halt. If the Kristang had ever seen a Mad Max movie, they might have taken their inspiration to build that vehicle. It was based on a large truck that had been retired from service because two of its four motors were burned out and the frame was cracked. In its new role, the truck did not need to drive far, nor did it need to maneuver over uneven terrain. It only needed to climb the ramp into the open. Once the truck reached the surface and drove onto a hard ceramic pad that had been set down to hold its weight, it stopped, and explosive pistons fired downward to bore into the pad, holding the truck in place securely and permanently. The truck was a one-use, last-ditch measure of desperation that had been slapped together from spare parts, partly as a sign of defiance to the clan leadership who denied essential resources to the guards responsible for the base. There was no funding to install the planned anti-aircraft missile batteries, and no spare parts for one of the two AA Maser turrets? Fine, the defenders had said. Screw the clan leadership. We can provide for our own defense. And so they did. The old truck was modified to carry an active sensor array, an energy shield generator on top at the front over the cab, a thick stack of heavy power cells, and on top in the back, a box containing six portable anti-aircraft missiles the humans called Zingers. The Zinger was designed to be carried by infantry, but was a versatile weapon that had been adapted for use by aircraft and even ground launch sites as sort of a cheap and short-range AA defense. Seconds after the truck's wheels ground to a halt just beyond the top of the ramp, the launcher pod rose up on its mount, swiveled, and fired three Zingers at the closest dropship.
"I'm going for the deck."
Irene pushed the Dodo's nose down in a power dive, knowing she was too close to outrun the short-range missiles. To her right, Derek was activating countermeasures to confuse the missile guidance systems, and the Dodo's defensive Maser turrets began to engage targets. With power directed to the craft's energy shield and point defense Masers, there was no energy available for the main Maser cannons, and their missile bays were empty. Flying high cover above the base in her Vulture, Tutula had been frustrated and bored, irritated to be kept out of the action. She knew her part in the operation was vital, and still she chafed at being inactive. Even when defenders attacked the away team, she had been forced to hold fire because the other dropship was in the way. Now she had a threat she could engage, though her own missiles had all been expended. The last two missiles were loitering above the base, being held in reserve to deal with unexpected threats. With the other dropship fully busy fighting for its own survival, she retasked a pair of missiles onto the enemy truck, seeing them instantly shed their wings and streak down at full power. As she pulled her craft into a tight diving turn, she warmed up her maser cannons and began hammering the truck's energy shield. Irene dove straight away from the oncoming missiles, being careful not to make a turn that would cause the tail of the dropship to block a maser turret from line of sight to the missiles. The point defense masers were on automatic, and she had faith in their abilities based on her training and simulations, but the system was not perfect, and the pilot operating manual stated it worked best when the ship they were attached to flew straight and smooth. Yeah, she thought, try doing that when people are shooting at you. The Zinger was not a sophisticated opponent. Its warhead could only switch between direct impact and proximity kill modes, not having the capability to project its own maser beams and not containing submunitions or countermeasures to spoof defenses. Regardless, her trainers had emphasized that the Zinger could be a deadly threat to a dropship at low altitude. Even her small Dodo dropship was larger than a Boeing 777 and ungainly in an atmosphere. Fly, she told herself. Fly the ship and let Derek and the automated defenses do their jobs. She aimed for a gap between two tall warehouse-type buildings, beginning to reduce throttle and pull the nose up. One down. Derek's terse report was delivered in a strained voice befitting the occasion. A maser turret had scored a direct hit on a Zinger, getting lucky as the wildly jinking missile flew into the path of a beam. The missiles had popped up after launch and were now above them. He knew Irene was hoping ground clutter would confuse the missile's sensors, and he prayed she was right. Pulling up, Irene announced, having no choice unless she wanted to pancake the ship into the ground. The maneuver worked as planned, between the countermeasures scrambling the Zinger sensors and ground clutter making the dropship hard to find, both of the enemy weapons temporarily lost target lock. One of them slowed and turned aside to get a wider angle perspective, its momentary straight flight making it an easy target for defensive masers that cooked off its warhead, sending shrapnel in every direction. The second missile never hesitated, as it had expected to receive sensor data from the missile that sacrificed itself. It did receive data from its own sensors, backscatter from the maser beam that pinpointed the location of the dropship inside its fuzzy stealth field. Instantly, the missile resolved the target from the ground clutter and adjusted course, deciding to detonate its warhead on proximity mode at the last second. "We're hit," Irene grunted, as alarms blared and red lights flashed in the cockpit. One engine began to tear itself apart. She reached for the controls to eject it from its pylon, but Derek had already acted, and the craft jerked again with the sudden loss of weight as explosive bolts blew the pylon away from the wing. Irene almost lost control, the flight management system not wanting to do what she needed to do. Didn't the stupid computer see the warehouse they were about to crash into? Going to full power on the remaining engine, she rolled the ship to one side to avoid the starboard wing clipping a rooftop as they roared past. "More missiles inbound," Perkins warned. "Tutula? We could use some help here." Tutula was having her own problems. Both of the missiles she tasked to take out the truck had been intercepted and destroyed by Zingers launched in quick snapshot that she had to admire, and now the truck's missile launcher was swiveling upright to reload from the magazine below. Hits from her maser cannons only made the truck rock side to side. Its energy shield deflected the maser pulses aside to sear the ground around it. She needed to get closer so the energy of her maser beams was not weakened by passage through the atmosphere. She needed to get closer without being shot down, or she would be no use to anyone. "Coming," she acknowledged, and turned toward the other dropship that was wobbling and trailing smoke. Her only hope would be to draw attention of the missiles away from the crippled ship.